In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. Hello to everybody. It's good to be back in Fresno. The topic of tonight's lecture is faith and science. Can science and religion live side by side in modern society? Let me begin with a short introduction, then I'm going to get into the body of the lecture. Science and religion are obviously two crucial forces that have shaped our civilization, especially in the West. Now, they did not used to be completely independent of each other centuries ago. In other words, back then, there was not a strict specialization of tasks in society. So, for example, you would find folks that simultaneously would work on discovering the inner workings of nature and develop ideas concerning a supernatural, divine, morality, life after death, so on and so forth. So we didn't have two classes of folks, scientists and theologians. This kind of distinction really didn't exist up until recently in human societies. But as societies embarked on a path to specialization, religion and science started to grow apart. So they sort of parted ways, especially in the Western world. And I want to underscore that if you visit Eastern societies, the line of demarcation between science and religion is not as stark as what you would find in the West. But even in the Western Hemisphere, we find that to this day, religion and science interact with each other in our daily lives. Particularly at the political level in the U.S., we see the interaction of religion and science a lot. In that vein, there have been a number of questions preoccupying intellectuals and philosophers. What is the nature of the relationship between science and religion? When do these two come into a conflict? Are they destined to negate each other? These are very important questions, albeit they may sound philosophical. Now, I urge you to keep these questions in mind as we go through the lecture tonight, because even though I don't directly answer these questions, but indirectly I'll do my best to come up with answers to these important questions. Tonight, we will examine some aspects of the relationship between science and religion. And as you know, the literature on this topic is extremely vast. It is impossible to condense all of that in a lecture. So I'm going to pick a few themes that are more appealing to the general audience and try to develop that. Let me also say that tonight when I refer to the phrase religion, I do not have any particular religion in mind. So everything that I have to say here tonight equally applies to Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and so forth. It is customary to have a general conclusion at the end of each lecture. But so you can follow the lecture more easily, I'm going to give you the grand prize at the very outset. There are two core messages that I would like to share with you tonight. First, science and religion deal with overlapping areas of human life. They do not contradict each other, they complement each other. The second message is that we should always allow for a line of communication, a dialogue to exist between science and religion. Everything else that I have to say tonight will be in the service of developing ideas towards these two important messages. Let me begin the body of the lecture going over an unmistakable trend in the modern world. The modern world has witnessed the retreat of religion and the advancement of science in the social arena. This is a very important trend. You see, not long ago, the province of religion used to be far bigger than what it is today. For about 1,000 years in Europe, during the so-called Middle Ages, religion and its official caretakers, or the clergy, were the final authority in almost every aspect of human affairs. Religion used to be the final authority on the law, politics, and even on ideas relating to cosmology, nature, so on and so forth. Now, over time, intellectuals of different motivations and different stripes put together a solid case for shrinking the social domain of religion. In other words, they made a case for closing off areas that traditionally belonged to religion. Most importantly, the study of societal affairs or social affairs, the study of diet and health, the economy and finance, the law, and also nature parted ways with theology. This was a very important development in human civilization. So, suddenly, there were a huge number of new intellectual disciplines that got created. By the way, this development, parting ways of various branches of knowledge from theology, was in line with a general trend in the modern world towards greater and greater specialization. Now, each area of human thought declared a sort of independence. Each area of human thought became an enclave, an autonomous enclave in the universe of human thinking and human thought. So suddenly a lot of new disciplines emerged. Biology, cosmology, criminology, sociology, psychology, chemistry, physics, genetics, even political science, all of these disciplines suddenly emerged. Now, the curious point is this. Even though, you know, we have now a lot of new disciplines on the stage, there seem to be a lot of dissimilarities between them. Biology and sociology, genetics and physics, they really deal with distinctly different subject matters. In other words, the subject matter of biology and sociology are not the same. The question is this: what unites all these different branches of human thought that I just referred to? What unites all of them? What unites these dissimilar areas of thought is a unique method of inquiry, a unique method of acquiring knowledge. What is the name that we use for that unique method of thought? The scientific method. So even though the subject matter of all these disciplines are different, the method of investigation and inquiry is the same between them. Now, let's go over very briefly on what the scientific method really entails. Have in mind that we are trying to determine what really separates the study of religion, theology, from the sciences. So this method is very critical to have a good grasp of. Very briefly, the scientific method really refers to a body of techniques for investigating various phenomena, a body of techniques for acquiring new knowledge. This method, the scientific method, is based on gathering observable, empirical, and measurable evidence. What are the key words here? Observable, empirical, and measurable evidence. So we have an idea, which in science we call it the hypothesis. In order to make a theory out of that hypothesis, we have to go through certain steps. These steps are really the facets of the scientific method. Number one, as I mentioned earlier, is observation. In other words, when you want to prove a scientific theory, you can't just go and lock yourself up in a library and just read books. Somehow you need to start observing facts that you are trying to gather information about. So observation is the first important facet. The second one is called description. Description basically means that the information that you present as evidence must be replicable. In other words, it has to be repeatable, one-shot deals. Things that happen randomly or every now and then cannot be construed as scientific evidence. It has to follow a repeatable pattern. Now, the third important facet of this method is prediction. In other words, all the information that is collected must be valid for all observations made in the past, present, and the future. In other words, the hypothesis that becomes a theory once the data is collected must enable us to predict both events that happened in the past and events that happen today, as well as events that will happen in the future. So prediction is an important facet of this method. Lastly, falsifiability, which basically means that for a hypothesis or theory to be scientific, it must lend itself to be disproved. You see, if you come up with an idea that cannot be proven false, that idea can never become a scientific theory. In other words, that hypothesis must allow a way for alternative hypotheses to prove this one false. Now, to summarize, whenever we employ this method of inquiry, no matter what we are investigating about, the fruit of our work is going to be considered scientific. Let me repeat. Anytime you employ this method of inquiry and apply it to any subject matter, then the fruit of your investigation is going to be called scientific. It is really this unique method that lies at the heart of science. And this method separates science from philosophy and theology. In other words, by definition, philosophical ideas and theological ideas do not lend themselves to be studied and verified using this new and unique method of inquiry. Now, using this method, obviously, scientists have come up with an immense amount of knowledge for humanity, to the extent that some people now view science as a new religion. Actually, back in the 1900s, we had a school of thought called scientism. It was an ism, a philosophy, as opposed to other philosophies that existed at the time. So, this unique method is very empowering for humanity. Having said that, there are limitations to science and what this unique method can discover for us. So I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about the limitations of science. Why is it that science cannot cure all the ills that humanity have? You see, all the branches of science are very intriguing. They are legitimate, fascinating, and they are indispensable. I'm not standing here in front of you to question the authority or the usefulness of any branch of science. Yet, the enormous growth and potential of science has given a false impression to many people that science is the only valid and worthy form of knowledge. And I submit to you that this is a misperception. There is a misperception out there, especially in the academia, that humanity should rid itself of any ideas, any thoughts that are not scientific. How many of you have heard of the school of thought called positivism? Okay. Positivists basically had this idea that knowledge could be divided into two areas, positive knowledge and negative knowledge. And this, by the way, there is no moral tone to this separation. And what basically they meant was that religion, philosophy, they are called negative science in the sense that they are not verifiable. We cannot really call them disciplines that provide knowledge. They only provide opinions to humanity. Science, on the other hand, is not about opinions. It's about proper and precise knowledge. So it was the positivist idea that as humanity progressed over time, the domain of science will expand and the domain of non-science will shrink and ultimately non-science will wither away. But obviously the reign of positivism didn't last very long. Even in the late 19th century, positivism was dethroned because positivism could not verify itself using what it was preaching. So in other words, there was an inner contradiction in positivism itself. That's why, you know, it withered away, and today, thankfully, not too many people take this school of thought seriously, although we do see the remnants of that in our academia still. Now, science is extremely proficient in what it does, but it cannot do everything that we need. You see, in the Middle Ages, in the Western experience, religion was top-heavy. Folks in Europe had a so-called maximalist approach to religion. They wanted religion to give them everything that they could possibly need. What I'm saying is that, unfortunately, some people exaggerate about the potential of science just as some people exaggerated about the potential of religion to solve all sorts of problems that we have. There are limitations to science and the scientific method. Let me explain in greater detail. You see, the scientific method teaches us how facts in the world are related to each other. Again, facts can be societal, psychological, or natural. So here we're not talking about any special facts. But basically, science is very good at describing how facts in the world out there are related to each other, how they are conditioned by each other. In other words, how one thing, one phenomenon can bring about the emergence of other phenomena, how facts are conditioned by each other. In other words, science is very good at giving us objective, factual knowledge. It's very proficient in that. Yet, a person can have the clearest and most complete knowledge of what is, and yet not be able to deduct from all of that what ought to be. Let me repeat what I just said. You can have all the knowledge in the world concerning what is, facts in the world, but from all of that knowledge you cannot deduct what ought to be, what must be. Science can teach us how chemicals bond, but it cannot tell us how we should live. It cannot tell us what goals we should have in our lives. It cannot tell us what aspirations we should have in life. Take all the knowledge contained in physics, genetics, chemistry, zoology, all of that knowledge. Yet, they cannot inform you on what you should do when you encounter a needy person after you leave this lecture hall tonight. All of that scientific knowledge can't help you whether you should assist this needy person or not. It is a moral dilemma. It's a moral dilemma. With the same token, it is almost impossible for science to say whether abortion is moral or immoral. At best, science can perhaps teach us when the neural template is complete and thought begins. That's the best science can do. But the final call is always a moral one. Along the same line, science does a great job teaching us the inner workings of nature. Yet, science cannot teach us what we need to know the most these days: how to value nature, how to respect nature and not destroy it. This is a very important issue that I just raised. Science cannot teach you whether you should use or abuse nature, whether you should destroy nature following your selfish ends, or whether you should respect nature as a living, breathing entity that has rights. Now, here we have faced the limits of the purely rational scientific conception of our existence. Now we've hit the limit of what pure rationality can possibly do for us. Objective scientific knowledge provides us with powerful technologies, powerful tools and instruments for achieving certain ends. Yet, our values, our inspirations, and our ultimate end in life must come from another source. The longing to carry out our plans, the longing to follow our aspirations, has to come from another source. In other words, there are basically areas of life that fall outside the proper realm of science. Ethics and the arts are just two examples. Ethics and the arts are two examples that are outside the proper realm of science. Now, these areas, such as ethics and the arts, are no less important for the fulfillment of the human spirit than knowing how chemicals bond, than knowing the proper orbit of Mercury around the sun. Just the fact that ethics and the arts cannot be investigated using the scientific method does not mean that they are unimportant. The reason I keep repeating that, because I hear in the academia still strands of thought that advocate, like positivism, that whatever cannot be studied by the scientific method is unworthy. It is unimportant for the fulfillment of human happiness and human spirit. If I were to put all of this in philosophical language, science is very good at answering the how questions. For example, how did this immense universe come into being and evolve over time? However, science is inadequate in addressing the why questions. Very good at the how questions, not very good at the why questions. For example, why do we have a universe to begin with? Science cannot teach you that. Let me give you another example. In times of crisis, why should I sacrifice my life So my fellow citizens live in peace and prosperity when my sacrificing action means the end of my life. I won't be here to reap the benefits of my sacrifice. I won't be here to share the windfalls of the peace and prosperity. Why should I sacrifice my life? You see, these questions are called meaning questions. Questions that have to do with the meaning that our lives should have. There are no equivalent questions in science. This is the important thing that I want to share with you. These questions are not even brought up in mainstream sciences. Yes, in fringes, you know, on the outskirts of science, some people may talk about them. In my opinion, they are really philosophical-minded folks that talk about them, even though they wear the hats of scientists. But these type of meaning questions, religion historically has been very good in addressing them. Questions such as, where did we come from? Where are we going? What purpose should we have in our lives? These sort of existential questions lie at the heart of religious thought. Science could never, ever replace religion because our sense of being propels us to ask these important existential questions, questions that the scientific method cannot address. But I submit to you, each and every one of us has to come up with answers to these existential questions, or else we cannot have a truly meaningful life. The bottom line is this. In terms of fulfilling the human spirit, there is a lot to be said about the world, both physical and the living world, that is completely outside the realm of science. Science and religion employ different methods. They address different questions and they have different focus. They deal with fundamentally separate aspects of the human spirit. They deal with different dimensions of reality. It is precisely such fundamental differences that has led some keen observers to say that science and religion do not conflict because they do not entirely exist in the same plane. Because they do not exist on the same plane at the same level, they don't conflict. The late celebrity scientist Stephen Jay Gould actually was a proponent of this idea. He mentioned that faith and science can live together because, as he said, they are non-overlapping domains. They just don't touch each other. Since they have no common grounds, they will never clash. You will clash with your neighbor if your turf overlay each other. If the turfs don't overlay, there is nothing to clash over. Now, I've been pounding this idea tonight that science and religion have different focuses, different methods, and so on and so forth. Yet it is wrong to conclude that they have nothing to do with each other. Actually, there are times that even though these two domains are separate, they actually come into conflict. Let me explain a little bit. Sometimes there is an intersection of interest between science and religion. We find narratives on the origin of the universe and on the origin of the human species. We find narratives about Adam and Eve, Noah's Ark, and the splitting of the river in front of Moses and his tribe in sacred scriptures, such as the Bible, the Quran, and so forth. Now, this is precisely the area where religion is stepping into science's turf. See, that's an area that you find narratives in Holy Scriptures, and it happened to be the area that science finds itself to be extremely powerful at discussing things. It is precisely this area where we find most of the tensions between science and religion. Let me give you a very concrete example. The first chapter in the book of Genesis in the Bible states that God created the heavens, the earth, and all the creatures in 6 days. Scientific estimates for the age of the universe is roughly 13 billion years. Obviously, this number keeps going up. I remember when I was in college back in the 80s, that number was 6 or 7 billion years. The estimate for the age of Earth is something around 4.5 billion years. According to scientific estimates, the first humans appeared on the Earth around 100,000 years ago. Now, if you compare what the book of Genesis says with scientific estimate, does not add up. In other words, these claims seem to be contradictory. I don't want to get into this contentious debate between the proponents of evolutionary biology, creationism, and intelligent design. That's out of the scope of this lecture. Suffice it to say that if one holds a literal reading of the Bible, then there is a conflict. But I want to tell you that there are quite a few non-fundamentalist Christians who really don't see any conflict between the Bible and evolutionary biology. There are quite a few non-fundamentalist Muslims who don't see any conflict between what the Quran says regarding the origin of species and origin of the universe and what sciences teach us. Let me give you a couple of names so that I'm not vague in this regard. I'm sure you've heard of Dr. Francis Collins' name. He's the head of the Human Genome Project, arguably one of the most important scientific projects in recent times. Dr. Collins is a top-notch scientist, but at the same time, he is a devout Christian. He actually came out with a new book recently. The title of that book is very intriguing: The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. Actually, according to Collins, genetics is the language that God Almighty used in order to create all the species. Let me give you another name. Stanford biologist Joanne Roughgarden. She also published recently a book called Evolution and Christian Faith, and in that book, she tries very hard to put forth a Christian defense of evolutionary biology. The point is this: these folks are simultaneously scientists and believers in God, and they don't see any conflict between the two. I could give you names about Muslim scientists who corroborate the views of Collins and Roughgarden. These believer scientists don't see any contradiction between their holy books and science, even on the issues of the age of the universe and the origin of species. Why? Why is it that they don't see any contradiction, even though on the surface, the numbers just do not add up? Let me talk about that for a few minutes. You see, these believer scientists maintain that the point of sacred scriptures is not to teach science. You see, first we need to set our expectation of what religion is all about correctly. See, if you start with the false expectation, that will lead you to false conclusions. Can you imagine God lecturing to the people of Israel on radioactive decay. I mean, that it would be nonsense to them, right? Absolutely nonsense. The Bible, the Quran, they are not meant to be scientific textbooks. Cardinal Borromeo, who was a colleague of Galileo, once said, "The Bible tells us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go." It's a very beautiful way of putting it. The Bible does not tell us how the heavens go, but how we should go to heaven. I think most Jews, Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists share the sentiments of Cardinal Borromeo in that regard. Sacred scriptures simply wish to say that this world was created by God. See, this statement is not an afterthought. It is a very important statement that one can say. In my personal humble opinion, one of the most profound statements one can ever say is God exists. It's just that most of us don't really ponder the consequences of this profound statement. Sacred scriptures basically say that this universe, this world, was created by God. In order to teach this important truth, these sacred books express themselves in terms of the cosmology in use when these books were written. So whatever cosmological ideas were around back then would be incorporated into these holy books, and in my opinion, it makes perfect sense. What else do you expect? We should not let the arcane language, the arcane formulations of these sacred scriptures get in the way of the message that these books have for us. Unfortunately, some of us get bogged down in the specific formulations and we forget the message that these books have for us. Scriptural stories convey timeless truths about God, about human beings, and the proper relationship between the Creator and creation. These truths have been expressed in a form that can be understood by people from all walks of life across geography and history. I'm going to come back to this important point, that the language that religion uses cannot be the language of philosophy, for an obvious reason. Philosophy is always, forever, for the elite. Religion is for everybody, and probably even more importantly, for the common folks, for the average folks in the street. Now, science-related references. Science-related references in all sacred scriptures should not be viewed as scientific theories about nature. Let me repeat one more time. Science-related references should not be construed as scientific theories about nature in holy books. Rather, those references are meant to be pointers, reminders. Reminders to all of us that great intelligence is built into this vast universe in which we live. The nature in which we live is not dumb. The nature is not spiritless. Go back to the thinking in the 19th century. The way most scientists approached nature was as if nature was inanimate. That's why they did whatever damn they pleased to nature, and now we are paying for it. It's a very important truth that religion teaches us, that this nature in which you live is not spiritless. It's not dumb. It is living, and you should respect it as you respect any other living phenomenon. This universe, this nature, is the work of an intelligent, compassionate, and caring creator. You should value this nature, not abuse it. You should live your life in a dignified manner, with assurances that everything that you do, no matter how minute, counts. Everything that you do matters. Every little thing that you do will resonate throughout time. Anything that you do is not going to be lost. It is safe somewhere. This is the wisdom that religion teaches us. Be mindful that you are in the presence of such majestic greatness. So behave appropriately. Behave appropriately. If you were to ask me, what does religious morality mean? I would say religious morality is the appropriate behavior in the presence of God. So when you are in the presence of God, you should behave. That appropriate behavior is captured in religious morality or religious ethic. Now, all of the things that I just mentioned to you, they are not objective, factual, scientific knowledge. They are wisdom. They are wisdom, but they are not factual or objective scientific knowledge. You see, knowledge and wisdom have different foundations. Knowledge and wisdom have different foundations. Objective knowledge is ultimately testable. Wisdom, on the other hand, is beyond testing. You cannot set up an experiment to test wisdom. Let me give you an example from the Holy Quran, and I'm going to come back to what I was just talking about, the difference between wisdom and objective knowledge. The story of Moses and the Pharaoh. Now, I submit to you, if you read the Quran cover to cover, you can't tell much about the real person of Moses, the historical Moses or historical Pharaoh. You can't tell how old Pharaoh was when he died, what the name of his mom was, what kind of food he liked to eat. See, this is the kind of factual knowledge that you would find in history books. Yet Quran is not a history book. It is a book of wisdom. That's why when you read the story of Moses and Pharaoh in the Quran, it is as if it is your story that is being painted right in front of you. It is by design. It is by design. The way the Quran is written is to engage the reader. That's why intentionally a lot of factual information is omitted from this book. It is not a defect. It is not a structural flaw in the book. Rather, it is by design the way it is written, so that it engages you, so that you realize that every single one of us can either be Moses or Pharaoh. As Rumi, the great Iranian Muslim mystics, would say, Moses and Pharaoh are not two historical personalities. Rather, there are two diverging aspects of our own character, which is, I think, a true statement. Now, let me go back to what I was talking about, the difference between knowledge and wisdom. You see, you cannot set up a scientific experiment in the lab to verify all the wisdom that I alluded to a few minutes ago. That wisdom is true, but is not subject to experimentation, because this type of truth is of a different order. Of a different order. You see, religious truth is of a different order from scientific truth. The purpose of religious truth is not to convey scientific information, rather the purpose is to transform hearts. The point of religious truth is not to convey scientific information, but to transform human hearts. It is very hard to envision a test that could tell the difference between a universe created by God and a universe that appeared without God. You see, even if we could manage to go back in time to the time of the Big Bang to see whether God actually was behind the Big Bang or not, you would see just the Big Bang. You would never see the hand of God. See, a lot of people think that if we could just, jump on a spaceship and just travel back, to the point where the universe started, we could perhaps see the hands of God creating the universe. That's not the case. Even if we were an observant back then, we would just see Big Bang happening. We would see chemicals interacting with each other. We would never see the hand of God. What I'm trying to say is this. We cannot apply the criteria of scientific truth to religious claims. We just cannot do that. Or else, if we try to apply the criteria of science to religion, we would be making a so-called category mistake. A category mistake in philosophy is when we confuse the classification of objects. We have classes of objects. We have, let's say, human beings, and we have rocks. But we make a mistake if we apply concepts that are unique to the human category to rocks. I submit to you that a lot of us make these kind of category mistakes all the time. That's the source of our confusion. Let me give you an example of a category mistake so you can appreciate the importance of what I said before, that you cannot apply the criteria of science to religious claims. In a sonnet, Shakespeare may refer to his beloved as a rose. Now, a scientist standing by would say, this guy is an idiot. A woman cannot be possibly a rose. Shakespeare knows that his beloved is not a rose. But that doesn't mean that describing his beloved as a rose is not telling the world a lot about how he feels about his beloved, what she is like, what love is all about. You see, here we are talking about two different facts. A fact that Shakespeare is talking about, love, and another fact, a physical fact, that the scientist is referring to. You see, these two facts, even though they are different, but they don't have to be contradictory. They can live side by side, even though they are judgments about exactly the same phenomenon. It's a very important conclusion. It is possible for us to look at the same thing, but have different ideas, form different ideas about them. To sum up, applying the criteria of science to religious claims, such as the age of universe, the story of Adam and Eve, the Noah's Ark, so on and so forth, is making a category mistake. This brings us to another important point regarding faith and science. Science does not contradict the idea of God. Let me spend a few minutes talking about that. You see, some professors of science talk about scientific discoveries in such a way that science contradicts God. In other words, the way they present scientific discoveries, it leads you to the conclusion that God does not exist. In other words, the way they talk about these discoveries leaves no room for God, no room for soul, no room for the presence of a divine grace in human life. the Nobel laureate James Watson, co-discoverer of the molecular structure of DNA, actually was one of these guys who was, in my opinion, very confused. He said at one time, "One of the greatest gifts science has brought to the world is the continuing elimination of the supernatural." In other words, the progression of science through history is as such that it leaves no room for God anymore. Frankly, these folks go well beyond science in their assertions. They confuse their philosophical beliefs with what science actually says. Atheism is a philosophy, not a product of science. Atheism is a philosophy. It may be a valid one for a lot of people. Nonetheless, it is a philosophy. It's not a requirement for doing science. There is a philosophy that many folks working in the physical and biological sciences take for granted. This philosophy at one time was called materialism. Some refer to it as physicalism. Yet others refer to it as naturalism. All these three basically say exactly the same thing. It is the belief that the physical universe constitutes the totality of reality. The physical universe out there constitutes the totality of reality. On this view, there is nothing beyond the physical, no trans-physical reality, no supra-sensory reality. And so the entirety of reality is, at least in principle, fully describable and understandable by empirical sciences. Let me repeat. If you really believe that the totality of reality is out there in the physical form, then by definition, science has the sole jurisdiction over this realm. This view is so widely taken for granted today that it is often equated with science or with the scientific point of view. But I'm here to argue that naturalism, physicalism, and materialism, these are not scientific truth, but a philosophy that some, and by no means all scientists, hold. It is a faith position. It is nothing but a faith position. There is, of course, as we know, a competing outlook to this materialistic viewpoint, which we call the religious outlook. The central feature of all world religions is the belief in a reality that transcends the physical universe. By definition, this supranatural, this transcendental reality does not lend itself to the scientific method of inquiry. Again, that's just by definition. However, this doesn't mean that this suprasensory, supranatural, supraphysical reality is just an illusion. It doesn't mean that. Just because it cannot be investigated by the scientific method doesn't mean that it is a delusion, as Freud would say. Contrary to this idea, all religious schools of thought argue that this transcendental reality we call God is accessible to the spiritual aspect of our very nature. Even though the scientific method cannot access it, our spiritual aspect can access and investigate that phenomenon. In theistic theology, such as Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, how do we refer to this spiritual aspect that can come into contact with this divine entity called God? How does Islam or Christianity formulate this spiritual aspect of us that can come into contact with this transcendental entity called God. It's by a metaphor. That metaphor is the image of God. We were created on the image of God. We all have the Spirit of God in us, the Holy Spirit in the Christian theology. It's basically an aspect of our existence that is very capable of coming into contact with supernatural phenomenon. By the way, in Hinduism, they call this spiritual aspect Atman, or in Buddhism, they call it the universal Buddha nature. The same idea that is prevalent in all religious schools of thought. Now, this religious belief in a transcendental reality, of course, contradicts materialism, contradicts physicalism and atheism, but it does not contradict science. It contradicts materialism and the materialistic outlook, but not necessarily science. It is very unfortunate that some members of the scientific community use the platform of science to push their own philosophical viewpoints. When a scientist says that science is in the process of proving religion a delusion, when a scientist says religion is nothing but superstition, that person is abusing the platform of science. What he says may be valid from a philosophical standpoint, but it is not supportable by science per se. These folks, such as James Watson, are scientists who subscribe to philosophical materialism and atheism, just as there are scientists out there who embrace religious faith. Frankly, I don't see anything wrong with a scientist who holds an atheistic outlook on life. I don't see anything wrong with that. However, it is wrong to package atheism in a glossy wrap and then sell it as science. That's a disservice to science, in my opinion. In the final analysis, religious belief and materialistic belief are equally faith positions. And as Søren Kierkegaard would say profoundly, faith always involves risk. Both religious and naturalistic or materialistic faith involve risk. In the case of religion, what is the risk? The risk is we may be fooling ourselves that there is a God. We may be fooling ourselves that there is life after death. So nobody can ever prove that. If this idea of life after death was provable, then you could never assign the title faith to it anymore. You see, faith emerges where science stops, where absolute proofs stop. Then faith kicks in and starts going. Now, what is the risk of embracing the materialistic faith and belief? The risk is that we are closing our eyes to the most important reality out there called God. You see, that's the risk you're taking, that now you're blind to the most important reality out there, and that's the beauty of faith. It involves risk. I guess we have another 10-15 minutes left, so let me quickly go over another important subject, the need for dialogue between science and religion. So far I've been saying that science and religion are marked off from each other. However, it is wrong to conclude that they have nothing to do with each other. In fact, there is a strong relationship, strong dependencies between religion and science. Albert Einstein was very mindful of this relationship when he said, "Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind." He was very mindful of this relationship. It is extremely essential to have a healthy dialogue between science and religion. This dialogue is instrumental for the future of religion. Let me explain. Everything you see in the world out there is susceptible to disease, decay, and corruption. Everything you see out there. Plants, animals, buildings, humans, they all at risk of contracting a disease or falling apart. Every single entity out there is susceptible to corruption. Religion is also at risk of harm and injury. Just the fact that religion has a divine origin doesn't mean that it is excluded from the risk of decay and corruption. What do you think is the disease that can afflict religion? What is the decaying element that can strike religion? Superstition. Superstition. Superstition is the most important disease that can attack religion. Now, this shouldn't be construed as a structural flaw or defect in religion that is susceptible to superstition. It is in the very nature of anything that exists in the world to have interactions with its surroundings. Now, when you have interactions with your environment and surrounding, there is always a chance to contract a disease or catch a bug, right? The world of ideas, human groupings, institutions are no exception. They are susceptible to decay and corruption. In my opinion, one effective mechanism to reduce the risk and the exposure of religion to superstition is to open a dialogue, a line of communication between religion on the one hand, science and philosophy on the other. I don't have time to go over it, but for good reasons, science and philosophy are not susceptible to superstition, even though they have their own diseases, but not this particular one. After all, religion lives in a universe of ideas. It doesn't live in isolation. It gives and takes. And just because of that, it can catch a disease. Religious thought should advance in line with advancement in human intellectual progress, or else it will fall behind and face extinction. Throughout history, only religious traditions that have kept pace with the scientific and philosophical achievements of every era have survived. This is a very important message to religious folks in the audience. We used to have a lot more religious traditions than what we see around. Many of them went extinct. Why? Because they did not evolve. Those surviving religions have a distinguishing mark. All these surviving traditions have been receptive to challenges posed by science and philosophy. They embrace critique and then they upgrade their discourse appropriately. Now, keeping pace with science and philosophy doesn't necessarily mean that we are diluting the original message of religion. It doesn't mean that. What it means, though, is we are delivering the original message using a different medium. We are changing the medium that is appropriate for the contemporary era, but we are not changing the message itself. Using the analogy of marriage, the religion that is married to science today will be a widow tomorrow. Why? Because science by nature is very unstable. Scientific theories come and go. Contemporary physics is very different than its counterpart during the era of Newton. A religion that is too close to science, too thoroughly accommodated to any branch of science, will soon be obsolete. On the other hand, a religion that is divorced from science today will leave no offspring tomorrow. Religion cannot ignore questions posed by sciences. Religion cannot live without fitting into the overall intellectual environment around. This basically means that we need to read and understand our holy scriptures, whatever that is, the Bible, the Quran, the Torah. We need to read and understand our scriptures in light of what science and philosophy offer us today, so we can change and adjust our language, our theological formulations, and the medium. I'm here to argue that it is possible for science to bring deeper meaning to religion instead of eroding and undermining its basic tenets. For example, astronomy in the past few decades has been very successful in putting together a coherent story of how the universe began. This story of astronomy does not contradict God. Instead, it enlarges our idea of God. So we shouldn't take these astronomical ideas as contradicting God. I strongly believe that the dialogue of science and religion matters a great deal, because the future of our planet depends on this dialogue. In the new millennium, we are faced with four interrelated challenges: war and peace, rapid population growth, economic development and economic equality, and the environment. These are the four important interrelated challenges that we are facing today. Science cannot teach us what we need to know the most about any of them. Religion doesn't have ready-made and easy answers to these challenges either. However, I believe that religion has and offers a comprehensive worldview within which we may be able to work out some answers. Science can provide us the technical tools to tackle these challenges, but the availability of the technical know-how is not enough. We also need to have a vision. We need to have the proper values and a resolve to solve these important problems and face these challenges. Without the right vision, values, and a lot of resolve and commitment, we cannot solve these problems. Science cannot give us these. They must come from another source. You see, science discovers and presents facts to us, but it cannot dictate moral imperatives. Science is very good at discovering and presenting facts to us, but it cannot issue a moral imperative to solve the problems that we have, such as poverty, violence, discrimination, global warming, environmental degradation. The imperative must come from another source. You might ask, why is it that science cannot give us the moral imperative? I've already given you the answer, but let me reiterate. Nature is value-free. There are no values embedded in nature. Now, applying the scientific method to study a value-free nature will not inform you of the proper values that should guide our public policy. It just cannot do that. It cannot inform us on these values, nor can science instill a sense of commitment and resolve in us to act and face these challenges. That is why we need science talking to religion and religion talking to science to figure out who we are, where we are, and what we ought to do. Again, this dialogue is absolutely important. We're running out of time. Let me summarize my lengthy lecture into a few statements and then close. First, pitting science against religion is a disservice to human progress. Science and religion fulfill separate roles. Each role is extremely important for the fulfillment of human spirit and happiness. Two, we need to strive for both outer as well as inner development. We need to strike a balance to harmonize outer development and inner development. Science and technology do very well serving our outer needs and outer requirements. Historically, religion has always been the vanguard of human inner progress and growth. So, science and religion not only can coexist within one person, but can do so in a fashion that enriches and enlightens the human experience. Number three, science and technology have given us immense knowledge and immense power. But we also need wisdom not to abuse the knowledge and power. There is a proverb, I don't know where it originated, but the proverb says, the faster a blind horse runs, the sooner it will perish. We can run very fast on the wheels of technology and science, but if we are blind, if we don't have wisdom, it will not lead us to the proper destination, it will lead us to our demise. And finally, this is my message to the religious folks in the audience who are very suspicious of science. It is extremely important for religious folks, in my opinion, to respect science as is. To respect science as is. We should never ever dictate terms to science. We should never tell science what it should discover and what it should not. As religious folks, we cannot pick and choose the knowledge that science presents to us. Because some of us have this tendency that whenever there are scientific discoveries that are in line with our way of thinking, then we call it real science. And then if there are ideas that are not in line with our way of thinking, then we call it unreal science. In my opinion, this is a very bad position to take. The fall of the totalitarian states in the Eastern Bloc, if nothing else, should remind us of the danger of dictating terms to science. Those of you who are old enough to remember the Soviet era, it was the policy of the Communist Party to dictate to scientists what they should discover. So ahead of time, the Communist Party, they would say, this is what you should discover. So anything that was out of line with communist ideology was supposed to be hush-hush. You don't say it in public. Now, this attitude, this outlook on science didn't really help matters in the Eastern Bloc. Back then, facts were accepted or discarded according to what the Communist Party would say. What is the message here for the religious folks? The state-sanctioned science was not science, but ignorance. With the same token, religious sanctioned science may be good for short-term political power, but it is bad for both science and religion. Religious folks must stand for the truth wherever it leads them. So if we find that science truly reveals something new to us, that is not in line with the way we interpret our sacred scripture, we should try to change our interpretation of the scripture. religious-sanctioned science is not true science, but science fiction. Thank you very much for your attention. I hope this lecture was of some value to you. God bless you all. Thank you very much.